Mini episode 1002 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to mini episode 1002 of the FDH Lounge. This is FDH managing partner Rick Morris, here with one of our favorite FDH Lounge dignitaries, Steve Callis. We have heretofore, I believe, only ever with Steve done sports segments previously. This is the first time we are going to branch beyond that with him. We're doing the Billions Season 3 recap, as Steve is an enthusiast of the Billions show, and it has been sort of a great pleasure of mine in getting ready for this show here and getting some notes from Steve. I know that there was initially, I don't want to put words in your mouth, Steve, not necessarily trepidation or anything like that, but what's this going to be like? I know how our sports segments go. There was a little bit of that in there, and I knew at a certain point as you were preparing there would be that kind of light bulb moment where it would be pretty much the same as anything else that we do on this show, because we like to tackle everything in sort of a uniform kind of a style here. Sports, TV, politics, anything else, kind of come at it the same way. And clearly from your notes, from your preparation, from your thoughts, you got to that point. The light bulb went off. I know that you know you got this, and this is going to be a great discussion.
Well, I will say one of your great strengths is the ability to do so many different things. I'm kind of limited to sports and maybe the law, but I'm a big Billions guy. You know that Lara grew up in Inwood, which is a neighborhood in Upper Manhattan where I happen to grow up.
Right.
So I do have a few things to say about Inwood and Lara, but I have to say it was actually a ton of fun just prepping for this. And I hadn't watched the final episode until like 10 days ago, because when these shows end for the year, Rick,
right,
you have to wait so long for next year.
I know.
I just like them to linger for at least another week or two, because I just want it to linger. I don't read anything about it. I don't go on any, you know, site to look at anything. I just want to read it, but see it. But I do kind of stretch the end of these things out. You know, things like Mad Men or Breaking Bad or, of course, The Sopranos. I always did like to let it go a few more weeks. That way, for some reason, I think I just hold on to it longer.
No, well, listen, I appreciate the sacrifice you are making and acquainting yourself with the end of Billions Season 3 so we can do this. And I feel the same way. It's a long wait until Season 4, but I feel like we're going to give people something to hang on to here. And again, this is one of my favorite parts of the whole FDH Lounge project is doing TV reviews and previews, as it were. And through the course of the season, we've been doing a top five format every week of top five things to look forward to for the next episode. So the basic format that we're going to do today are the top five themes of Season 3 as I rank them out, and I will have you react to them. You have had a chance to look those over, think through them. But I know that another part of your process has been in terms of getting ready for this. You were talking about it a little bit to me off air, the whole thing, as well as texting to me. Some of the things about the way that this is a peculiarly New York show, the way that it is set there, and the way that you guys who are from the area who know the geography inside and out, there's levels that people like me aren't even necessarily getting when we see this that makes it that much more of a quintessential experience if you live there or you have lived there previously.
Well, yeah, and I would just say as one great example, the very first episode of Billions, which is what hooked me on it right away. I liked it immediately, but I loved it because it turns out that Lara is just, you know, a middle-class, lower-middle-class kid from Inwood. Inwood is Upper Manhattan. It's the last neighborhood of Manhattan. Harlem goes to the 150s. Washington Heights goes to 200th Street. And Inwood is a little, now hot neighborhood, I'm told. Not so hot when I grew up there. From 200th Street to the Bronx, which starts at 225th Street. And Lara, in the first scene, and you'll recall, you know, this all started where Bobby Axelrod, it was kind of a Cantor Fitzgerald thing from 9/11, you'll recall.
Right.
People had passed away, and they were giving out scholarships. And a woman whose husband had died in 9/11, obviously Axelrod lived, and was trying to do things for, you know, poor kids, scholarships, etc. One of the women who was a wife of one of the people who had died publicly made some complaints about Max and what he was doing. And Lara simply took her to the side in season one, episode one, and gave her a two-minute discussion on where she's from, she, Lara, being from Inwood. That is the perfect description of the neighborhood I grew up in the 70s, into the 80s. And I assume with them, the 80s, maybe into the 90s. And that was, look, if you have a problem with me, come see me. But if you ever make your problem with me public, or with my husband public, you got a real problem. You're out on an island. You're by yourself. Never do that again. And it was just such a perfect description of how it was where I grew up that I was like, wow, whoever wrote this stuff grew up where I grew up. And I'm still trying to find out who that person is. Has to be one of the writers. But that's just one example of many. There are a lot of, you know, to me, Billions on a much smaller level is like a Woody Allen movie. People say to watch and understand fully a Woody Allen movie, you have to be either Jewish or from New York or preferably both. I'm not Jewish, I'm Greek, but I'm from New York, and I roll in the aisles when I see Woody Allen movies. So there are a number of things. Maybe we'll talk later about the egg cream when we get into Ira and Chuck and their meeting in a diner. But just there are some things along the way that remind me so much of where I grew up. And perfect to a T was the Lara speech in season one, episode one.
Absolutely. And her character is very interesting. It was something that really roots the Axelrod family to that blue-collar upbringing. We saw a lot less of that in season three with her being divorced from Bobby. Hopefully we'll see more of that as we go along, and I think we will. I think season three was a certain kind of peculiar direction where it was just dealing more so on the high finance end. I think it's probably going to loop back around and connect more to her and the surroundings that she came up from, even if it's only tangentially. My guess is we'll see more of that in season four and beyond. But a couple of the characters you mentioned there, that sort of sets the tone for number five here on our list of the top themes for the season. So here's our number five theme. Proof that there are no permanent friends or enemies, just permanent interests, comes in the form of several settled feuds. Chuck versus Bobby, Chuck versus Charles, Chuck versus Ira, Wendy versus Laura, and Dollar Bill versus Spiros. Now, the last of those, Steve, was a high comedy kind of one, and probably the lowest stakes of the bunch, although I don't think Spiros would agree with that since his Porsche got totaled at one point. But relative to some of the other things there, that one was kind of played more for laughs. But it was very, very interesting because as the year went along, this is one of the big ways that season three differed from seasons one and season two, that you saw a lot of these blood feuds really kind of dissipate as the characters were finding out what they had in common in terms of their interests, and really sort of maybe in a way being cynical and putting it aside. Maybe Chuck, for example, maybe he felt some guilt towards Ira, and I guess he kind of did, but at that point, it was interesting the way that they kind of came back together. Wendy versus Laura. I think Laura probably just didn't feel threatened by Wendy anymore, partially because of being divorced and partially because I think maybe she saw she was being irrational about seeing Wendy as a threat. Chuck versus Charles, that wasn't even a feud at the beginning of the season. It was just maybe kind of an underlying thing. It verged into being a feud with Chuck's gubernatorial campaign and some of the things happening. But again, Chuck versus Bobby, that's the big one right there. That was the defining feud of the series, and now it appears to be in the rearview mirror. So very, very interesting that season three, it was a matter of bringing people back together off of these feuds, not necessarily, of course, in a feel-good way, because Billions is not a feel-good show, but people being sort of canny and putting their heads together and seeing that sometimes there's bigger fish to be fried than maintaining a kind of rivalry or grudge.
Yeah, I find the Chuck versus Bobby one obviously the biggest one, the most important one, the most interesting, and it shows, and I know we're going to talk about this later, the power that Wendy has become both within the show and with both of them. Having said that, long term, I'm not sure that can last. You know, the key line in that whole season about that was when they finally sit down, the three of them, and I don't mean in the last episode, I mean before that, when they go essentially, how how do they trust each other? Chuck goes, how can I trust you? Bobby goes, how can I trust you? And of course, Wendy says the famous, trust me. She just kind of has become a character that takes over virtually all of these meetings, whether in the office or with Bobby or with Chuck or with both of them. So I know we're going to get to Wendy later, but the Chuck versus Bobby thing I find fascinating. I guess it turns out to some degree, at least towards the end, pointing towards season four, they kind of need each other to do these things. They both have separate skills that maybe they can mix together. You know, the final scene, they're talking about what they're going to do next, you know, season. But I find that one, on the one hand, the most important one. On the other hand, I just can't see that lasting through the end of the series. I'll be very surprised. And maybe a bunch of these are going to reverse. I don't know. Chuck versus Charles is interesting because it's the, you know, quintessential father-son. Is the son growing up like the father? Yeah, it looks like he is. And Charles did not seem to be happy until, and I'm quoting here, until Chuck, quote, totally fucked me. That's what Charles says to him at the end when he finally makes the call to have his stock, to have his investment in that upstate casino become totally worthless because Jack Foley, who, of course, Chuck also had a big disagreement with eventually, had made it so Charles is the father's investment in that upstate casino is worthless. Only then did it seem, as weird as that is, that the father was proud of the son, and I don't think it's too far of a statement to say, like father, like son. Chuck has certainly done some things that would make us, the audience, or even us, the human beings in our daily lives, just kind of shake our heads and go, really? He's really going to do that? And the answer is, yes, he really did do that. So I find that one interesting as well. Chuck versus Ira, you know, I can't believe any best friends would do these things to each other.
Right.
But that's exactly what happened. And they're not little slights to, I don't know, make a little money or, you know, maybe tell a small falsehood about each other. Obviously, these are major things where Chuck essentially bankrupted Ira to get Bobby with the ice juice stuff. And Ira, for his part, I'll take you to the egg cream scene where Ira's still furious at Chuck. Chuck walks in. I don't think he knows Ira's there. He just wants to go for a walk. Ira's there. Chuck sits down, orders an egg cream, which I'll get into in a minute. But then they have a back and forth where essentially Chuck offers him that nothing job for $350,000 a year, kind of get him back on his feet, get him connected in the court system. And Ira essentially says, I don't want anything from you. I never want to see you again. But during that scene, they put an egg cream in front of Chuck. And the egg cream, again, is a New York institution. There were two thoughts of where it comes from, and I don't want to go too long on egg creams, but just so everybody else in the country knows who listens to this, the egg cream is a quintessential New York drink. I heard that it was made by Jews in the Lower East Side 100 or more years ago, and there was a very rich drink for rich people that had eggs and cream in it, and the poor people on the Lower East Side of New York took the eggs and the cream out, just had literally syrup, milk, and seltzer all together. That's an egg cream. You can still buy them in New York. They're not as prevalent as they used to be. I encourage anyone who goes to New York to try and find a real candy store and get an egg cream. My complaint, though, is that they used the definition of egg cream from Paris, where there was something that sounded like egg cream in French, whereas there were two thoughts of where it came from, and there's no doubt in New York it came from Jews on the Lower East Side, so it would be interesting to see who wrote that and what it was. And my only complaint, and this is really going deep into the weeds on egg creams, there's not 10 people in the whole country who would really know this or even care about it, frankly, Rick, but I think it's worth mentioning because they bring these things up in New York. When you have an egg cream, when you make an egg cream, when you have a straw in an egg cream, first of all, it's supposed to have a head like a beer. Couldn't really tell on the show when I saw it. But the other thing is, at the end, there's Chuck stirring his straw round and round on an egg cream. And the beauty of the egg cream is you never stir round and round. You only move your spoon or your straw up and down. That's to keep the head prevalent. Again,
sure.
I don't know if anybody cares about that, but it's a fascinating thing. And if you have an egg cream in New York, and I'll give you the perfect analogy, if you have beer that doesn't have a head, what do you have? You got a flat beer.
That's
right. If you have an egg cream that doesn't have a head, what do you have? You have a flat egg cream. So that was one very incredibly picayune, you won't read that anywhere else in the country, criticism, but I love the fact that they went into the whole egg cream. And of course, eventually with Chuck and Ira, I don't know what this is, they screw each other over so badly, Ira $30 million, right? Bobby gives him $30 million, so he flips on Chuck and Charles. They screwed each other over so badly, yet at the end, because of the whole thing with Ira's new wife, they kiss and make up again. I don't know how realistic that is in real life. When you see the vitriol, for example, from Charles to Chuck, and then from Ira to Chuck, and then somehow all in this season they make up. I guess it's a TV show on the one hand. Would that really, really happen in real life? I'm not sure. But you're right. These are perfect groups that you've laid out of people who have permanent interests. Your words, brilliant. But really not permanent friends or enemies for that matter. The only thing I'll add, Wendy versus Lara, I'm a little concerned. I don't think, you're right, they made up. They had that Lara apologize, and Wendy says, I can give you some, you know, psychiatrist for your kid. And then Wendy says, you know, you got to go talk to Bobby about comp day, because you're the one, I know you're the whole behind it. But I don't quite buy the Wendy versus Lara. Yes, she's divorced, but she still loves him. Bobby kisses Lara in that one scene, and he wants to, you know, make love to her. And she's like, no, we're not going to do that. So maybe you're right. Maybe she stepped away. But I still think always, especially with two women and a man, or two men and a woman, you know, I don't know that ever really, really, really gets healed. So I think a large part of the story is which of these is going to blow up again, because, you know, some of them are going to blow up. And Dollar Bill and Spiros, you're totally right. It's one of the funniest things. And, of course, they get back together with the SEC scam that they're now working, so they're on both sides of the aisle. But running into the Porsche is one of the funniest slash greatest scenes on a side level of a show that I've ever seen. You're just cracking up while Spiros is losing his mind.
That is some great entertainment right there. But, again, there's a number of levels that this show is working on. Looking at theme number four, the show's commentaries on trends in society, from a parallel version of the Trump administration to a Russian titan who was a clear stand-in for Putin, to the role of automation in decreasing the number of necessary employees on Wall Street, continue to be very compelling. And again, more than any other season, it seems like Billions was doing a decent amount of ripped from the headlines type storylines. Very interesting. And again, 2017, of course, was, as we know, those of us acquainted with basic American civics, that was the actual first year of the Trump administration. And the show basically continued on in the parallel universe with not Loretta Lynch as the attorney general on the show. And we get, who I would say, not Jeff Sessions here, except I don't think that Jock Jeffcoat is meant to convey him necessarily at all. Much more Trumpian of a figure as the attorney general. But again, this year was the year that they really, really sort of committed to trying to put the show in the moment. And again, somewhat of a departure from past seasons. Very interesting the way they pulled it off.
Well, I understand what you're saying. I thought there was at least, yes, Jeffcoat is more Trumpian in the way he is, but I will say this. I think there's a reason Jeffcoat's name is Jeffcoat, given the fact that Jeff Sessions is the real Jeffcoat, if you will, in
sure.
real life.
Uh-huh.
And I also thought there was something, and maybe I'm just jumping out here, but I just thought there was something in the fact that Jeff Sessions is, you know, is a very tiny, very small, you know, killed on social media for being so small.
Yeah, right.
Jeffcoat is a gigantic,
yes.
big, strong
right.
guy. I don't know if that was someone just goofing. I don't know. I don't know where the politics on these guys are. I'm going to guess they're somewhat liberal-leaning, just from the general liberal-leaning, not necessarily even of the show, but of what all these writers essentially are. I could be wrong, but I will say this. The one direct conversation or smack at Trump is when Chuck tries to bribe Spiros or threaten Spiros, he wants him to testify as to what was happening inside Axe Capital, and Chuck goes, you know, I have that thing on you, and Spiros goes, you mean that old date rape allegation? And here's his quote, Spiros to Chuck, quote, say it loud, they might even make me president. obviously a reference to the tape and all the accusations against Trump. That was the one direct thing I thought I saw that was obviously, on the one hand, critical of Trump, on the other hand, saying Spiros is right, you know, whoever's gone under because of the Me Too movement, whoever those people are, and there's lots of them, It sure isn't the president of the United States
right now.
And that was Spiros's and, of course, the writer's point. So I do think you're right about them getting a little political. And again, maybe that came because whatever you think of the Trump administration, it is like no other administration in the history of the United States.
That's right.
As for the, again, these are fantastic. I mean, you're right in terms of the commentaries on trends in society. These topics are great. John Malkovich as the stand-in for Putin is, and we'll talk briefly about, I think he's the biggest threat in this whole thing, forward-looking. But, you know, he does whatever he wants. He's certainly the quintessential our general view of Putin. You know, he's the man in charge. He says fuck you to everybody. He gives Axe $3 billion. He takes out $1.5 billion just to test them. And you know, frankly, that's kind of what Trump does as well. So there might be all kinds of, from Jeffco to the Spiros comment to the way John Malkovich is, that might also be kind of a commentary. You know, he can get Maria Sharapova to play tennis with Axe. You know, those guys, he's checking Islanders all over the ice hockey rink, and, you know, maybe he's going to buy them. So he's one of those guys. He's got more money than God and does whatever the hell he wants. Having said all of that, I think with respect to him, and I agree with you, he's Putin-like, and this is especially timely in light of the fact, now they didn't know this when they made that episode, I'm sure, but, you know, now that these guys are going to sit down for a one-on-one with just interpreters, Trump and Putin, I think in a few weeks or a month or whenever it's going to be. But what I find to be most troubling, and I don't mean troubling like it bothers me, I mean troubling for the characters and the series forward-looking, whether Axe likes it or not, he's gotten into bed with John Malkovich. And I don't know how he's going to get out. They had that great conversation in the car between Axe and Hall where they go through, well, if you say yes to him, in terms of do they want to kill Taylor, does you know, Axe want Taylor killed? And he's like, no, I want to make him suffer and that stuff like that. But the problem is, well, I want to make they suffer. That's what I have to say for Taylor, right? I have to use the right. No, I, you know, that's right. A whole other thing, this non-binary gender thing, which, by the way, is a good sidelight of the story in terms of its importance outside of the series.
That's right.
But also, to some degree, inside. But I find the problem is now that he went and got the money, he got the $3 billion, took $1.5 billion out, and he gave it back to Axe because he didn't whine or complain, you know, that whole scene. But here's the problem, forward-looking. I don't know how Axe gets out of this, because at the very end, Malkovich says to Axe, he goes, well, look, you better not hurt me.
Right.
And if he's actually going to give his money to Taylor, and Axe destroys Taylor, and that's his goal, that's what he said to whoever he said it to, Wendy or somebody else, well, that's going to, by definition, hurt Andelov.
Yep.
So I don't know where that goes. I think he's in trouble. And by the way, if I could just say, if Putin understands, because Putin, if Andelov understands, because he calls Taylor she
right
one time, you'll recall, it seems to me that in Russia, where, you know, gay people, and I'm separating them from non-binary gender people,
right,
who must be weirder to the Putins of the world than gay people, if gay people are persona non grata in Russia, and I believe they are, why would he even do business with this guy? I think he might just go kill Taylor just to kill Taylor. I don't know what's happening next year, obviously, but I was trying to think it through. How does Axe stay out of trouble with Andelov? And I don't have the answer, because either way he goes, as they talked, if you say, yes, kill Taylor, he's got something over you. He, Putin, has something over you. If you say, no, don't, and Andelov gives him the money, and you destroy Taylor, you're really going to hurt Andelov.
Right.
So how does that shake out at the end? I'm not seeing any. It came to me that Andelov would kill Taylor just on his sexuality.
Right, right.
In the real world, if you will. But again, I mean, that's for the future. I just find that whole thing a little strange. But you're right. We have the Putin-like character. We have some comments on the Trump administration. And finally, the whole thing with Quants. When I was watching the whole thing with Quants, which is a thing on Wall Street, hasn't taken over yet, but there certainly are, you can buy or invest with people who just have quants. They just have computers essentially picking the stocks. Now, as with everything, the humans have to input the information. But I'll give you this analogy. I'd say in the last 5 or 7 years, at least at the three New York airports, in the old days of 6 or 7 years ago, you can walk in, go to a restaurant, get a waiter, order your food, blah, 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 blah. And then about 5 years ago, it started to be they had these things on the tables, right? I'm sure you've seen them. I'm sure they're in most airports now, where you just punch things on the tablet on your table to order. You don't even talk to a waiter.
Right.
You know, somebody might come over and give you water, but you have to order on the tablet. So I'd say maybe, again, 3 or 4 years ago, my son and I would go to the airport. As you know, my son is a big, you know, fight for $15 an hour and help the worker, and I'm with him, frankly. I agree with that. So we would always look for either a restaurant that had waiters or even within the ones that had some tablets when this was an experiment. We'd go wherever there was a waiter. We want to be waited on, and we leave a good tip, and that's how we think it should be. Flash forward to the last, I'll say, 18 months. I've been in the airport a few times, 4 or 5 times, and there are no Newark, LaGuardia, Kennedy in New York, New Jersey. There are no more someone comes over and takes your order in any restaurant in these three airports. And it's disconcerting. A guy like me doesn't want to punch things on a tablet. You know, you can go to McDonald's now, and they tell you, do you want to order on the tablet? I don't go to McDonald's much, but I do for breakfast sometimes. And I'm like, no, I don't want to order on the tablet. Can I tell you?
Yeah.
and so analogizing that and what's happened in the last 5 years, i.e., for example, at airports, you can't get a waiter. Now, somebody brings you out your food, and somebody takes your plates, but that's all they do.
Right.
So then what do you leave them, like, the full tip, like they waited on you? You have to punch through the, you know, I have a conversation. Of course, my son says, yeah, we leave them the full tip. They're still working. But that's leading to a cut in jobs,
right?
In many places, and will lead to cuts in thousands of jobs at McDonald's eventually. When I think it'll be like a toll booth. Toll booths. Once upon a time, there was a guy in every toll booth, right? There was somebody
right.
taking your toll. Then they invented Easy Pass, and now even in New York, you have a lot of places that are cashless tolls. You don't even there's nobody there. There's
right.
no there there. And then for a while, and still true at the George Washington Bridge, for example, there'll be 10 lanes. 7 or 8 of them will be non-cash. 2 or 3 of them will be cash. Those 2 or 3 are now 20 deep.
Right.
Everyone's got to get Easy Pass. That's where we're moving. So, too, and I think the stock market is behind that in terms of progression. I don't know. I wouldn't call that progress myself. But, yes, I think you're right in pointing out the number of necessary employees on Wall Street is decreasing, and I think that's going to be true. I don't think we're there yet like we are at the toll at the GW Bridge for restaurants and airports, but it's kind of getting there where there are going to be less and less people. And you can already invest in these. They're called robo-somethings. I don't know a lot about it, but they're called robo-investments or something,
right.
where they have a program, an algorithm, just like Taylor is talking about with his quant, with their quant genius, who's the one guy left. So, yes, I think these are all perfect commentaries that you brought out that are interesting topics for discussion, and hopefully I've just done a decent job talking
sure.
about them, because I found all three of them fascinating and agree with you that these were compelling storylines this season.
Okay, good. Yeah, I like the way you dissect those. Number 3, Wendy becomes an even more interesting character, coming to grips with her increased sense of ruthlessness at work, even as she becomes more of a useful consigliere to her husband. Now, on the latter part, Steve, that's something we really didn't see as much of in previous seasons, is her sort of taking the bull by the horns and trying to help out Chuck when she sees room to do that. It was not something that really got remarked upon much with the show. It was just something that you kind of picked up on as a viewer, that she was doing this a little bit more. And again, that set the tone for, we're going to be talking about this later at the end, with her bringing him and Bobby together and sitting down and hatching basically revenge schemes against all of their common enemies. But it's a matter also where this was a point that you had made to me, that when you look at some of the S&M undertones to her character, you had picked up on some Clockwork Orange type stuff that I thought was very interesting from a character analysis standpoint.
Well, I just find, again, Clockwork Orange, one of the greatest movies of all time. I encourage everybody to see it. I think it was X when it came out, so you should be at least 17 now, I guess, to see it. But at least where I grew up, we had what we called Clockwork Orange moments, which were like True Justice moments, which is the general rule that you learn, even if you never saw Clockwork Orange, is what? Treat people well all the time on the way up. Hey, you never know, you might meet them on the way down. Obviously, your parents want you to treat people nice all the time, no matter where you're going. But that's the general True Justice story of the creep who makes his way to the top, then gets knocked off, and on the way down, all the people he stepped on step on him on the way down. And I thought we had two moments. I do want to talk at length about Wendy, but two moments, one which included Wendy, which is when she and Chuck are going to see their mistress or the S&M woman, the Asian woman, and they walk in, and obviously Wendy says, you know, call me Chuck, call me master if you talk to me at all, and obviously she's got her S&M gear on underneath her coat, and then out of the side jumps Black Jack Foley and Chuck's father, Charles, and obviously they don't want Chuck to be doing this if he's going to run for governor, and Charles is a real hard ass and walks up to Wendy, who's got her raincoat on over her gear, if you will, and says, Wendy, why don't you take your coat off, it's kind of hot in here. And so they have that embarrassing, humiliating scene where it does dawn on Chuck that he obviously can't do this thing. You know, they even say, do whatever you want to do in your house, but don't come here. If somebody finds out, your governorship candidacy is over. And then flash forward to the end when Charles is waiting for a prostitute in a fancy hotel. You know, the beautiful blonde who shows up but gets, you know, afterwards we find out she shows up at the desk and, oh, that reservation was canceled. And Wendy has Hall cancel the reservation, get her a key to the room. Hall meets Wendy in the hallway. Hall says, you want me to wait? And Wendy goes, no, I got this. She walks into the room. Trump thinks the beautiful blonde hooker has come in, and it's Wendy, and he's in a bathrobe. And so, you know, they have an incredible back and forth, and she goes, Charles, why don't you take your robe off? It's hot in here. Exactly what he had said to her at the S&M place, and then said, you know, if you ever want to humiliate me or do, you should know who you're fucking with. Don't ever fuck with me again. She walks out. So to me, that's a Clockwork Orange moment. The other one I'll just mention briefly because I want to stay on Wendy is when Chuck Rhodes fires Connerty. Connerty tried to put Chuck Rhodes under. He screams at him in the hallway. Connerty thinks he has his job back, and Chuck Rhodes screams at him in the office, and says, leave your credentials at the desk and get the fuck out of here. Screams at the top of his lungs. And then, as you know, when Connerty and Oliver flip and go to the attorney general and tell him about the whole scam that Chuck is working with the New York attorney general to try and get the U.S. attorney general to, you know, obstruct justice, and Chuck walks into the office and they're there, and Chuck knows he's caught, and the AG says to Connerty, as the interim U.S. attorney, because now Connerty has Chuck's job, right, you know, leave this man out. And as he goes to the door, he looks at Chuck and he says, leave your credentials at the front desk and get the fuck out of here. Exactly the same thing to right. Me, again, those are Clockwork Orange moments. But again, back to Wendy, I mean, she's really, like, taking the show by storm. I don't know how, and maybe she doesn't know how she can. There's that one, I think Wag says to her, Chuck says to her, how can you give all of yourself to both of us? And, you know, she says, I can't, it's kicking the shit out of me.
Right.
But she's also totally taken charge when the AG, you know, is messing. You know, the AG wants to pick all the cases Chuck is going to prosecute. The Lugo case, the prisoner who was killed, but he was defending himself. They just want him to, you know, they want the guards to get off. And Wendy says to Chuck, quote, you have to assassinate this motherfucker, which
right.
leads to the failed attempt to make him look bad.
Right.
She seduces Mafi.
Right.
Which is kind of a sad but necessary thing to get Mafi to say that Wendy didn't call me, I called Wendy about the ice juice short, and then they were able to rig the telephone. That was Hall, blackmailing another guy who was able to change the phone records to make it look like Mafi called Wendy, which totally, you know, lost their case.
Right.
And so she just, there are a number, Chuck says he's going to turn himself in to protect Wendy, and Wendy says, no, you're not. Maybe the trust me part is in the very last episode, I don't remember, but when Chuck and Bobby are going to each other, how can I trust you, how can I trust you, she says, trust me, and that's the end of that.
Yes.
So she he was able to really take control of, I won't say everything, but virtually everything. I won't say everything because of the whole Taylor thing. When Taylor leaves, she didn't think he was going to they were going to leave. But, you know, she even got back at Taylor in the garage there at the end.
Right.
Where Taylor tries to recruit her, and she's like, fuck you. You know, that whole bit. But there are many of those. Now, I know she was tough with some people, especially workers in past seasons, but it never became clear, although it might have been clear to Blackjack Foley, who says, you know, well, it must be hard to serve two masters, or maybe they're both serving you.
Sure.
I thought that was a telling comment by Blackjack Foley when he had to interview the candidate's wife. Of course, he became not the candidate. But I find Wendy to be very complicated. I still don't know. When I look at it sometimes, I think, how could she marry Chuck Rhodes? How did that really happen? Not that, you know, I'm one to comment on relationships. But you know what I'm saying.
When right.
When you look at her and Bobby, maybe you could see that kind of, the billionaire hedge fund guy and her. And maybe they'll never cross those paths because they haven't so far. I would have thought if they were going to, they would have by now, especially since Chuck's Axe's divorce. I never quite saw the Chuck when, you know, she said things like, you're the greatest at working out a plan. I've never met a man you couldn't deal with. You know, gives him some incredible compliments, but I really thought it was over when he broke into her computer to get that information.
Right.
I thought that was going to be the end. So I don't quite understand the Chuck-Wendy marriage, but, you know, you love who you love, I guess, and we'll go from there. But, yeah, she's a very complicated character. She has become a useful, as you say, consigliere to her husband, and certainly in the last scene brings everybody together, you know, let's talk this over. And, you know, Chuck is saying things like, yeah, I don't have a grudge against you, Axe. I'm not the U.S. attorney anymore. I got fired.
Right, right.
And they're both willing, by the way, it seems like, to die for Wendy. So maybe Blackjack Foley is right. Maybe she's not serving two masters. Maybe those two guys are serving her. And maybe that's something that will be expounded upon in season four.
Well, she does have a dominatrix complex. And again, it's the closeness between Wendy and Axe, I think, that was the thing. And you saw it explicitly a little bit when Chuck, the jealousy right before he spied on her laptop was when he had spied on them being together and how they looked like a couple of teenagers. He said, I
at
always...
the office, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Outside. Yeah, you're right. Now that you said it, I remember that.
Yeah.
And then he just drove away. He drove away. He didn't even go up there. Yes, I do remember
that. That's
and don't forget also, she did have that, this isn't with Axe, but she did have that affair with the millionaire astronaut who blew up.
Right.
And asked Chuck if he had been following her. Of course, it was the father, Charles, who gave Chuck the pictures. But you're right. I think, and maybe this is sad, maybe I'm just being superficial, Rick, but certainly Axe and Wendy make a more, I don't know, believable couple than Wendy and Chuck. But hey, who knows? You know, I'll say it again, you love who you love.
Well, and that's the thing, too, is that if they fall apart at some point, this alliance, that's probably going to be why, because it's going to creep back in there, because Laura, that's the main reason that she was always suspicious of Wendy, because she saw this connection as well. I always thought what would have been hilarious is, because you're talking about this in a way where I'm going to even go further and say that Laura is somebody who definitely comes off to me as, I wouldn't have thought coming into this season necessarily shallow in terms of money, although she seems to be morphing into that. But shallow, at least in terms of other ways, i.e. she would never give Chuck Rhodes a second look. I always thought that if Wendy and Axe had something happen, Laura swallowing her bile to have revenge sex with Chuck would have been one of the most hilarious things. Can you just the close-in of the looks on her face as she's going through with that would be high comedy indeed.
I think she'd be closing her eyes myself. We're just
exactly.
Speculating here. We're just speculating.
Right. We're sort of booking this on the fly, as it were, you know, as we look ahead. But you know, we talked about the end of the big rivalry of the show, and we'll get to that more with point number one. But for point number two, the top five themes of the season, it sets up where we're going, the roadmap from here, at least through season four. Here's point number two. The show's titans, Chuck and Bobby, are upended by their respective proteges, Kate, Brian, and Taylor, as well as the Attorney General in Chuck's case. So you've got a circumstance where, again, it's the three on the one side here, Kate and Brian, who were underneath Chuck in the U.S. Attorney's office there, kind of learned at his feet, and as Kate makes very clear, just, you know, took that and eventually ended up using it for their own purposes someday. The Attorney General, who Chuck tried to bring down, who, because of them, and let's not forget Dake as well, looking for his own revenge, that they were able to thwart him. The Taylor thing, again, this is something where I saw it all season long. I kept commenting on this as we were going along and doing the previews each week here, that going back to when Taylor was running X-Cap, the way that X was surreptitiously trying to exert control and all these things here along the way, the seeds were being planted for an entire season in terms of where this was going. It's still, to me, I think it was great writing and directing in the sense that it was, the moment was still somewhat kind of shocking when Mace Capital was unveiled. And even though I had seen some measure of something coming, the subterfuge and the level of cunning that was used, clearly Taylor learned very well from Bobby, and I was put to use there. And again, each of them now upended by their proteges, Chuck and Bobby. And then, like I said, you throw the Attorney General in Chuck's case as well, an enemy there. So that's going to lead to, when we get to point number one, on why they're having to pool their resources, because each of them has made some very formidable enemies in terms of people who've been underneath them, plus the Russian billionaire in the case of Taylor, as you said. And I was highly anticipating the introduction of Malkovich's character, because these are the same writers 20 years ago that did Rounders. So we got a Teddy KGB-esque type figure there. The character did not disappoint. So you can see why Chuck and Bobby are going to have to pool their resources, because, again, these are very formidable enemies that they have made, those who learned underneath them. And I come back to one of these cliches from the world of pro wrestling, when you will sometimes see a break between teacher and student, and the teacher character will be like, I might have taught you everything you know, but I didn't teach you everything I know. And that's where they're going with this.
Right. Well, but it also seems like they taught on both sides.
Yes.
Chuck and his underlings and Bobby and Taylor, that they taught them so well. And, of course, you learn a lot by observing. You learn so much by observing on Billions and in life, that I think they, on both sides, learn so well as to be able to deal with, at least temporarily, take down Chuck. I don't know where that's going. And certainly at least to become a competitor of Bobby and Taylor's case, that you are able to upend them. The reason I wasn't shocked with Taylor, surprised but not shocked, is because Taylor kept the quant thing going away from Bobby. I know apparently
right.
Some people thought that he was, that they were going to perfect the quant thing and then Taylor was going to present it to Bobby, but
right.
I don't think anybody would really think that Bobby would say, oh, okay, you went behind my back when I told you not to do it and blah, 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 blah. I don't think Axe would ever have accepted it, even if it worked. So when I saw that, I was like, wow, there's only one goofy quant guy left who's a brilliant nerd, by his own admission, and Taylor. So
right.
they were doing that. So I wasn't shocked at that. It was interesting, though, that according, I think it was, to Wags, who is a whole other character who you could do a whole show on, but apparently after the big meeting at Citi Field where everybody comes with all the money, apparently Taylor was able to get 3.5 out of the $6 billion switched to Taylor, and it was Taylor who made the very impressive speech at the meeting. X kind of handed it over to Taylor.
Right.
Thinking maybe Taylor was in his corner. He had given him $20 million, even though he had given them $20 million, even though Taylor wanted $50 million. Put Taylor back on that raise committee, which was important, according to Taylor, who told Wendy, blah, 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 blah. But yeah, I think they just were able to so perfect. I personally was shocked when the New York Attorney General Epstein turned. And again, I guess because of Connerty and Oliver, turned on Chuck. And I think Kate Sacker, who's an interesting character, is trying to always play, she's just seeing which way the wind's blowing.
Right.
whichever way the wind's blowing, that's where she's going. Chuck is going to make her the head of Krim. She's there. But now she saw that he was going to be out because Connerty, who is viewed to be, you tell me, the goody two-shoes maybe, the last honest man maybe, he's like hurt by all this stuff, which is kind of naive. I don't know if that happens in real life. But he's presented as the good guy. And if I could just branch off for a second to Inwood, because the two Inwood guys that Laura knows, who, by the way, to me are like Inwood guys, guys in an Irish bar, and Connerty is from the Fordham section of the Bronx. Now, again, if you live in Inwood, you can walk over to the Fordham section of the Bronx. There's a bridge on 207th Street in Inwood where if you walk across the bridge, you're in Fordham in the Bronx.
Right.
And, of course, the two Irish guys, I assume they're supposed to be Irish because at least back then, it was a largely, the white people were Irish. I was a Greek, but most of the white people were Irish. And, of course, they had Dominicans and a lot of black people down by Dyckman Street in the projects. I live two blocks from the projects. And so those two guys, frankly, are kind of like Inwood guys, I would say, from at least the 70s and the 80s. Obviously, these guys must have been teenagers, I'm going to guess, in the 90s, maybe. But the stereotypical Inwood guy is kind of true. And, of course, they go, you know, we just kick you Bronx boys. We kick your ass for fun. And Connerty's like, no, that's not true. We come over to kick your ass. And I assure you nobody ever came over from Fordham when I lived in Inwood and did that in sports or fighting or anything. Of course, I'm biased. And let me just say one final thing on that, which kind of bothers me a little. If you see the bar where the Irish guys are always hanging out,
right,
and that is what happened in Inwood, at least in the 70s into the 80s, until most of the Irish guys left, there were 10 Irish bars in Inwood.
Okay.
It was an Irish neighborhood in a certain part of it, and then again, Spanish in another part, black down by the projects, where, by the way, Lou Alcindor, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, grew up in the Dyckman Projects.
Right.
And whenever you hear him say he grew up in Harlem, that's not true. And one time a reporter got him on that, and he said, well, yeah, but I spent so much time in Harlem, I feel like I'm from there. That's just another personal complaining aside. But the final thing I do want to say, which bothers me, is the bar Cullens, that you will see them go in and out, has been in a bunch of scenes, including this year when Connerty walks up to the guy and punches him in the face, sucker punches him before they get arrested.
Right.
When they try and come in and make those guys flip. I know those guys are never going to flip if they're from Inwood. It's kind of like a mob place, but with Irish guys instead of Italian guys, frankly.
Okay.
But the thing that bothers me is that Cullens is a real bar. It's in the Bronx. Now, I will say to you, there's only like two Irish bars left in Inwood. But boy, I would have felt a lot better if they went to like the Liffey 2 on Broadway, which is still there with the Irish flag hanging out.
Right.
Or even there's a bunch of Irish bars up on McLean Avenue in Yonkers where Axe grew up. But they decided to go to the Bronx. Now, again, nobody will care. Nobody will know this. But if you look at Cullens, next to Cullens is the Wakefield Pharmacy, and Wakefield is a neighborhood in the Bronx. Again, just letting some of my pet peeves go. But to get back to all of that, I just think it is true that the grasshopper, for lack of a better term, learns and eventually can turn on the master. And that's certainly what's happened as of right now on both sides. I don't think anybody against Chuck is ever going to wind up on Chuck's side. Or if there ever happens where Sacker could benefit by being on Chuck's side, I think she would be again. And nor do I see Taylor and Bobby ever getting back together again, which always takes me to the Bobby, I want total destruction on Taylor, and how that conflicts in my mind with what Andeloff has told Bobby, don't hurt me. And if you hurt him, when Axe says to John Malkovich, I'm going to make life miserable for this guy. I don't want him dead. I want him alive. I'm going to make him miserable. And when Angelo says, well, you better not hurt me, it strikes me how that can't happen. If you really destroy Taylor, you're destroying Angelo's money, no?
That's right.
So that's the most interesting thing. I mean, obviously it's fascinating to see, and I know we're going to talk about this, what Bobby and Wendy and Chuck are going to plot to do. That's next season. I understand that's the main thing. But I think a big side story is going to be, how can Bobby do anything to Taylor without infuriating Andeloff? And Andeloff is the guy who'll kill you at the drop of a hat. You remember the whole hot dog stand thing?
Right.
The guy with the cart, and he lost his arm because he said, yes too slowly or something. He would have been dead if he said no, but he said yes too slowly.
Right.
Or whatever the conversation was, I would have been very reluctant, if I were Rax, to deal with Andelof. And the only reason I mention that is because there was that other weird, pervert, funny Anisman character.
Right.
Who apparently they went to after Andelof pulled the $1.5 billion. I understand how it was disgusting. You don't want to deal with that guy, et cetera, et cetera. He was a slob. His money was weird, Jordanian money. But I would have gone to him first, no, Rick? Because whatever he is, he's not going to kill you. But Andelof and everybody, I got my eyes wide open, I said. Everybody knows that Andelof will, you know, kill you for sport.
Right.
So I know that, and I do want to mention the meeting between one final New York City thing, not an Inwood thing, the meeting between Freddie Anishman and Axe, and I think it was Wags, was at a place called Sammy's in City Island, an incredibly famous in New York seafood place.
Right.
Now, City Island, again, I tell anyone who comes to New York, go to City Island. It's part of the Bronx, but it's kind of a place unto itself. It is made up mostly of seafood restaurants right on the water, great food, great view. Lots of people go there. There is literally one bridge in and out, one lane in, one lane out. So if you want to go there on like a Saturday night in the summer, good luck.
Right.
But it's a fantastic place. Sammy's is fantastic. I've been there. I haven't been to the Hotsy Totsy restaurants that they all go to and eat in the city, like Danielle, where your bill for dinner for two is going to be, you know, $400 or $500. Haven't been to those places, but I've been to Sammy's. I used to live in Grace Papaya on 72nd Street. And those are real New York places that I think people should go. But I just thought, watching even that scene, as disgusting as this guy was and a pervert, why didn't they get the money from him? And I guess the answer would be we couldn't get $3 billion from him. We could only get $1 billion from him. But I thought that was interesting because I would deal with a sloppy pervert before I would ever deal with an Andelof character.
Yeah.
And I don't think they ever made the distinction, Rick, why they went to Andelof. The answer might be I need $3 billion, not $1.5 billion. Obviously, that's a big difference. But what Bobby's put himself in, and I'm sure that's going to be ripe for season four, what he's put himself in strikes me as a no-way-out kind of situation. I don't know how he's... I can't even think of it. I think Andelof might kill... If they want to kill Taylor off, Andelof's going to kill him.
Right, right. I think that's very possible.
I'm sorry. I've made that mistake many times.
It's a tough thing.
I don't know where that comes out. Obviously, it's going to be fascinating to see how Bobby makes his comeback and how Chuck makes his comeback, and I'm sure they'll come back. But the whole Andelof thing, to me, is a big monkey wrench, and I'll be fascinated to see how they extricate Bobby. Although, maybe they don't extricate Bobby. You know, that's another possibility, of course, in the end. Who knows? Maybe it goes bad for everybody in the end. You never know with these writers. But that's all the more fascinating for next season.
Absolutely. It really leaves a lot to look forward to as far as how that goes. And again, in my estimation, it's hubris on the case of Bobby. We saw it from him time and time again this year. And again, he thought that he could manage the whole Andelof situation, even when people are telling him that he can't. So that leads us to our first point, which a decent amount we've already talked about already, but I'm sure we'll have some more elements to talk about. The number one theme of Billions Season 3, after shockingly settling their beef under pressure in mid-season, the entire series going forward is upended by the scenario of Chuck and Bobby pooling their intellectual, financial, and Wendy-related assets in pursuit of the destruction of their new enemies. And again, this is a thing where I often say to people who don't know much about Billions, I always say, you have to sort of grade on the curve that it's like 40 years later and that it's on cable, so the standards for the writing and everything are a little bit higher. But I said, to me, it's sort of like the Dallas of today. If Dallas was on a little bit more elevated level of it, because, again, it's you know, in the 70s and 80s, you know, the oil fields and whatever, that was like the frontier. Today, it's Wall Street. And it's a lot of the same kind of, you know, rich and powerful kind of thing. But again, being that it's considered a mostly prestige drama, that, again, the writing and the plotting and everything like that is on a higher level. There's less soap opera-y stuff, not to say none, but less than Dallas had. But it's a thing where imagine JR and Cliff Barnes actually sitting down and realizing, hey, we got to work together on stuff. Because, again, this was a serious blood feud that there was between them. And it's one thing when they're both facing the fear of jail at midseason. But it's a thing where who knew that this throwaway sentiment was going to be something that would come back to loom so large. Wendy, in that conversation with Wags, saying, oh, you know, they actually got to be friends at first. They saw a lot of each other in each other, and they were the smartest guys in the room, and they knew it, and they sort of bonded over that, and it was very interesting. But I'll tell you that, and this is the point I'm going to leave it on as I throw it to you. I don't know that aside from any of the legal scenes, and there have been a handful of them where Chuck and Bobby are sitting on the other side of the table and whatever, I don't know that we've ever really seen Chuck and Wags mixing it up in a scene. I'm looking forward to huddles that involve those two, Wags making one of his flip references to something, and just the utterly bemused look that Paul Giamatti will bring as Chuck Rhodes in that moment. You got me really looking forward to season four thinking about that.
Yeah, well, I have to say, I thought one of Wags's finest moments in the whole season was when he bought the plot in that small cemetery in Manhattan, and just the whole conversation, not the way he shook down the ambulance chaser lawyer, I mean, that was typical Wags, but the whole pondering over a gravesite, you know, when whatever it is, I forget, the 60s is a good run, or, you know, all that kind of stuff, it was so fascinating. And then to conclude, of course, he lies down where his body will be and just looks up at the sky, and they have the camera from above. I thought that was hysterically funny. But he has so many, you know, I love the whole episode with the traveling Wilburys.
Yep.
And anybody who knows the traveling Wilburys, who really, when you look up the makeup of the group, you know, Roy Orbison, George Harrison, the guy from ELO, Lynn, God, I'm missing one quintessential... I can't believe it.
Let's see, Lynn.
Oh, Bob Dylan. Shoot me
right
now for forgetting Bob
right
Dylan. But the notion that Astyros, for example, like I knew at the end when he came back that they were still going to say, there's no way you can be a Wilbury. I thought that was just one of the funniest episodes. And then, of course, they played one of their songs, one of their great songs,
yep,
where Roy Orbison sings the chorus. I just thought it was so fantastic. So, again, there are so many references at so many levels, music, art, movies, and New York stuff, as I've tried to lay out a little bit here. I think it was just so fantastic. But I do have to say, looking at Chuck versus his problems and Axe versus his problems, although I think the biggest one in terms of life and death, if you will, is Andelof, I don't think Axe is going to really have a problem with Taylor. This will either be, there's enough for both of us,
right,
I think. But with Chuck, I don't know how he's going to get back at the whole, I mean, you're talking the whole establishment now. You're talking the Attorney General of the United States, Jeff Sessions' position. Again, not that Jeff Code is Jeff Sessions, but they hold the same office. In addition to now the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York, where honest, for lack of a better term, Brian Connerty is at least for now the head, although I can't believe Sacker is really going to like working under Brian Connerty, not something
right
anybody has mentioned yet, but she was made the head of CRIM, and so now she's now, first she was above Brian, now she's below him, and their relationship is a little bit strange to me anyway.
Right.
But whatever. I don't know, just thinking out loud, how Chuck gets back at that. I mean, that is the entire establishment. Plus, he walked away from being the governor, and he's kind of burnt some bridges there, certainly with with Black Jack Foley, who he set up, you know, with that thing so he could have that deal. They
right
had that on tape. He's also got this, I don't know if the Epstein guy is going to be back, but he is now the Deputy Attorney General of the United States. That would be the Rob Rosenstein. I'm not saying there's any parallels there, but that's his job. That's what he is now. I don't know if he's a one-shot wonder or if he's coming back. I just think in terms of getting back to a position of power, Chuck has a much bigger hill to climb than Axe. But again, maybe I'm totally misinterpreting this, but I don't know how Axe, he can deal with Taylor, I don't know how he deals with Andelov. I just don't know. And I'll say it again, if they're really going to go the Putin-like Russian oligarch, which is clearly what this guy is like, I have no idea how he could deal with somebody like Taylor, just from a straight up, you know, it would be the equivalent of a diehard racist in the South in the 1840s dealing with a black guy.
Right. That's a good point.
I don't know where that's going. On the one hand, I think professionally it's going to be tougher for Chuck Van X, but remember that final scene with Hall? He says, put extra protection on Lyra and the kids.
Right.
When he walks out of the whole Andelov meeting. So he knows there's something there. I don't know. So I view it as two different hills to climb, if you will. And I don't know that it'll be interesting to see, I guess, if Axe, Wendy, and Chuck have a conversation about what do IX do about Andelov, especially since I want to destroy Taylor. That's the most fascinating thing to me. And again, I might be totally out of line because that seems to me to be a gigantic life and death story as opposed to can I get back on my throne, which is what both of those guys want to be. They want to be kings. Essentially, they want to be the kings.
Right, right. I'll go out on a limb here. My early sense is that the strategy to come up with is to more or less not have fingerprints on taking Taylor down, make it look like a screw-up on the part of Mace Capital so that Andelov takes out the revenge. And because, again, I think that Bobby is going to second-guess not having Taylor killed, and that basically doing something, making it look like Taylor screwed up the money, that would be my early guess. And that would mean writing off Taylor. That would mean a very dramatic decision, but that would be sort of be my sense there. By the way, and you mentioned about Kate Sacker also. I'll mention this in my final comments here, played by the very beautiful Condola Rashad, which, again, parents, Felicia Rashad, Ahmad Rashad. As I always say, people, genetics are undefeated. And Condola Rashad proving that yet again. So, you know, yeah, it's going to be very interesting, the dynamic between her and Brian Connerty, as you said, going forward. That is an issue that has not fully resolved itself. Connerty leapfrogging her to get that position. I hope somewhere along the way they carve out something for Dake going forward, too, because I found him to be an interesting character. And, you know, he's gotten his revenge on Chuck, so one would think he's kind of redundant at this point. And revenge on Chuck.
Well, maybe Oliver's best line of the whole season is at the end when Chuck is fired, Connerty's walking him out. Chuck turns around and says to Oliver, so what did you get out of this? And Oliver said, I got the pleasure of watching all of this. I thought that was a classic line by him. He didn't want anything other than to be there, and he was there.
Yeah, yeah. It was really outstanding the way that it all played out. And again, the last 10 to 15 minutes of this season, the way that it unfolded with Chuck getting taken down by everybody working with the Attorney General instead of against the Attorney General and with him. And then the final scene there reprising the mid-season meet with Chuck and Bobby. And again, I'm looking forward to seeing what that is going to mean going forward, because it was sort of parallel tracks for the rest of the season there. It was sort of like, you know, whatever was the A plot and the B plot any kind of given week, and that these two guys who were always so intertwined, they were off on their separate paths, but it's clear that was a misdirection. They're going to be intertwined from here on in. But on the other side of the fence, as best friends forever, so to speak. And, well, again, we'll see how long that lasts. But however long it does, you know, Chuck being in the war room with Wags from now on, and Chuck dealing with the smarmy lawyer of that Axe has got, and all of that kind of stuff. Chuck and Hall, actually, that could be fun. And Chuck just kind of giving the eyeball, like, do you really exist? Is this real life? You know, I mean, there are so many things.
Talk about strange bedfellows.
Yeah, exactly. But enough about Wendy. But, you know, again, she is she is the link. She is the common denominator between them, bringing us all together. And again, she sits at the apex right now, the joining fabric, as it were, of billions as it goes into season four. And I know subsequently here in the coverage of Billions that, again, we'll want to get together and discuss this again. You always get a sense leading into a season, there's always hints of things to come. I know, like, the casting of John Malkovich was out there before season three, and there were some things. So some of the things we're speculating about now, some of the directions will become a little bit more apparent as we're going into season four, when there gets to be some casting news. And again, you know, is Dake going to be somebody that's still going to make appearances? If so, we can kind of speculate about that. We'll have a little bit more tangible to chew on as we head into season four. So I look forward to reprising the Billions talk as we go ahead subsequently. And as I say, I think this was long overdue for me and you to do our first non-sports segment between us. And again, it went just as beautifully as I knew it would. Thank you so much for being on, my friend, and for your great analysis, your breakdowns of what we saw with season three.
Thanks very much, Nick. Victor, was a ton of fun. I really had a great time. Thank you.
I really appreciate it, Steve. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to FDH Lounge mini episode number 1002.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.